Has your confidence ever been shaken for any reason? Now, the vast majority of us as human beings will go through periods of time or various times in life where, for whatever be the reason, our confidence could be shaken. Maybe it's at work, in whatever situation it might be. It could be at school. Maybe we didn't study enough for a test and our confidence is shaken when we have that test put before us. Maybe it's in sports where you find yourself in a situation to where your confidence could be shaken depending on the situation. Maybe it's in family where, for whatever be the reason, the confidence of the family is shaken for one reason or another. Maybe it's even in religion. Those of you who go back to 95, you might remember some people were very emotional. Their confidence was shaken. I remember meeting with a minister at that time, telling him that I recognize there's always change in life, but religion is constant. It's consistent. God is the same today, tomorrow, forever. And he said, no, it's changed. And I can remember thinking, this guy's confidence is shaken. He was trying to shake my confidence. So who or what do you have confidence in? I know that I used to have a coach who used to say, have confidence in your training on game day. That was one of his things that he would say over and over. Have confidence in your training. You've trained for this. Now go out and play. And there was a time where I played sports. I used to feel bad for my wife because I would drag her to whatever sporting activity was going on. But now I'm glad that she witnessed that I did play sports at one time, whether it was softball or basketball or the various things. But one coach that I had used to constantly say, have confidence in your training. What or who do you have confidence in? Do you understand exactly what does confidence mean? And biblically, how should we view confidence? Confidence, if you just take a definition, it means the feeling or belief that one can rely on someone or something. It's a firm trust or belief or conviction. So you can have a feeling or belief that you can rely on someone or something. You can have that trust, that belief, that conviction. And of course, there's the self-assurance and there's self-confidence, and something that's popular in society today is to have self-esteem, meaning that you're able to feel good about yourself and your abilities and what you can do as a human being and what you can accomplish. So we talk about self-confidence. And certainly there is an aspect of self-confidence that's appropriate. And what I mean by that, just like the coach that used to tell us, rely on your training, have confidence in your training. So if you are going to take a test and you have studied, you can go into that test with confidence. If you've done your part on a project at work, you can go into that meeting with confidence. That's appropriate. If you have trained for that sporting activity, you can go into it with confidence. Mark Twain once said, you only need two things in life, ignorance and confidence. I remember reading that thinking, what in the world does that mean? But if you have confidence and you're ignorant of whatever the outcome might be, you just go in it and do it. With all of his wit, there's some truth to what he's saying. And many people put their confidence in humanity. The other day as I was driving, I had a news program on the radio, and they were talking about the European space, I don't know what their technical term is, but their version of NASA, I guess, where they landed that spaceship on a comet. And they were talking to an engineer who was describing this to his three-year-old son. And all of a sudden it struck him that he could give his son an actual model of the comet to look at as he was talking about this spaceship landing on this comet. So what he did was he had a 3D printer at his home, and within 15 minutes he was able to pull up a 3D model on his computer of the comet, because the European Space Station had that online. So he was able to pull that up, download it to his 3D printer, and actually print out a model of this comet. And what it struck me more than anything else was how greatly knowledge has increased it's unbelievable with what we can do. So this three-year-old, instead of just talking about this spaceship landing on this comet, was able to actually hold it and see the valleys and the hills and the various things of the comet where this spaceship landed on. So it's no wonder that people can have confidence in humanity. So where do you place your confidence? Where do I place my confidence? Sometimes governments would like us to place our confidence in the government and what they're doing and how they're doing. The media would like us to place our confidence in them, so that whatever they're reporting or however they're reporting, we'll just take it as that it must be that way because it was on ABC, NBC, CBS, whoever, wherever. Politicians want us to have confidence in them. And of course, many people want us to have confidence in science and medicine and the fact that human beings, given enough time and enough money, as the thought goes, will solve all of humans' problems. And maybe you're thinking, I have confidence in my talents and my abilities, and I will put my confidence in myself to be successful. Well, what does the Bible say? Well, let's look first at Philippians chapter 4. Philippians chapter 4. I wrote down the wrong verse. Let's go to Philippians chapter 3. We'll start in verse 1 where it says, "Finally, my brethren, rejoice in the Lord. For me to write the same things to you is not tedious, but for you it is safe. Beware of dogs, beware of evil workers, beware of the mutilation. For we are the circumcision who worship God in the Spirit. Rejoice in Christ Jesus, and have no confidence in the flesh." So he makes it very clear that we should have no confidence in the flesh. And this way that Paul is writing this, we recognize it can be taken more than one way. He is specifically talking about in the circumcision, in that regard, as far as the Jews who consider themselves to be of the family of Abraham, Abraham as their father, and that this physical outward sign was pretty much all that they needed to show that they were okay, that they had confidence in religion, who and how they were. But it also means don't have confidence in the flesh. And Paul goes through and talks about that if anybody could have confidence in the flesh, he certainly could. He was a very capable man, religiously, physically, in all aspects of life. He was somebody that excelled in the physical life. And so he talks about that, that if it was possible just to have confidence in the flesh, he could do it. But whether we want to talk about circumcision, which I don't, except for in this context, or if we want to talk about what we're able to accomplish as human beings through our talents and abilities, the point is clear. Don't have confidence in the flesh, is the point that Paul's making, in our physical human lives, in our human ability. But let's look at an example of proper confidence. It's a story I think many of us will recognize, 1 Samuel chapter 17, one that we turn to often for this kind of discussion in the Bible. We're going to focus on a young man. So here we see David and Goliath. David was a young man. Jewish tradition puts him somewhere around 16 or 17. So we just talked recently about the fact that God works with our children, has a relationship with our children. And if our children are close to God, And we're teaching them about God's way of life. God can use them. And there's situations that we see where God has used young people. Of course, Jeremiah, going through the classes, it's estimated that he was somewhere around 17, 18, somewhere in that age group. David, again, Jewish tradition is that he was about 16 or 17 years old when this took place. We know he wasn't quite old enough to be full-time in the military, or he probably would have been there. He's still in the fields tending the sheep. But we see in verse 1, 1 Samuel 17, verse 1, says, Now the Philistines, they gathered their armies together to battle, and they were gathered at Succoth, which belongs to Judah, and it talks about where they were encamped. And Saul and the men of Israel, in verse 2, were gathered together, and they encamped in the valley of Elah, and drew up in battle array against the Philistines. So this was a situation to where they were at war. They were getting ready for battle. The Philistines brought all their armies together. They were in battle array. The Israelites come together. They're in battle array. So they're just facing off. The Philistines stood on a mountain on one side, and Israel stood on a mountain on the other side, with a valley between them. And a champion went out from the camp of the Philistines, named Goliath from Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. So we see that he's called a champion. And that term literally means a hero. And it means somebody that had been victorious in battle. So he's somebody that had fought enough battles, killed enough enemies, that he was recognized as a hero. There's other places where the men of Israel were called the mighty men of Israel. I think I'll just pause. It looks like Mrs. Carter or Miss Carter might be going. Is she leaving? So I would just make mention that she's very lightheaded and dizzy. And I did anoint her out there. That's why I went out. But I would recommend, if you don't mind taking a moment, to send up a silent prayer and ask God's blessing upon her. She was thinking about, or they were thinking of calling an ambulance, and it looked like people were just going out the door. So I would appreciate it if keep her in your prayers. Take a moment to say a silent prayer for God's healing and blessing upon her. Just continuing here in verse 4, again, where it talks about a champion. It literally means somebody who was victorious in contest or victorious in battle. So there's certainly a time in history, for example, Alexander the Great, if you've read about him and the Greco-Macedonians and their republic, that if you were mighty in battle, you could improve your status in life. So no matter where, what family you were born into, whether or not your family had land or money or anything of that nature, if you could win battles, win fights, you could improve your status in life and you could be elevated in your status. And that's a similar situation that we see here. This man, who was somewhere between 7 and 9 feet tall, we don't know exactly, but we know that he was a big man. And if you just read the description of his helmet and his shield and his spear, he was a strong man who was able to carry the weight of the equipment that he had. And he was a man who had been very victorious in battle. He had a reputation. Now, King Saul of the Israelites was, we read from Scripture, that he was head above everybody else, head and shoulder. So he was a tall man for that time. When I lived in Colorado, or we lived in Colorado, I used to play basketball with my cousins. So my mom has a twin, and he has 5 sons. The shortest is 6'4", the tallest is 6'8". And there are a couple of them that lived very close to us, and we'd get together and play basketball. Well, they were easily head and shoulders taller than me. Fortunately, they weren't as quick as I was at that time. I'm sure they're quicker than me now. But at the time, I could run at least up and down the court and occasionally get a shot off. But they did have arms that they could use as clubs to block shots. But they were definitely much taller. So we see that even though Saul was a tall man, Whether Goliath was 7 foot or 9 foot, he was a big man, and he was a mighty man as far as battle. So I wanted to just take a little bit of time on that, because the majority of the men in Israel's camp were very afraid of Goliath. So every day he would come out and he would taunt them and tease them and try to get anyone to step into the octagon with him, so to speak, and nobody was going to take a chance of fighting this man. It says more than once that they were fearful. They were afraid. Verse 11, when Saul and all of Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. So they were very afraid of fighting him and coming out against him. Verse 17, we see that Jesse tells his son David to take some food to his brothers. So he carries the food in. Verse 20, David rose early in the morning, left the sheep with a keeper, and took the things and went as Jesse had commanded him. And he came to the camp as the army was going out to the fight and shouting for the battle. For Israel and the Philistines had drawn up in battle array, army against army. And we know he left his supplies, he greeted his brothers, and then as he talked to them, there was the champion, verse 23, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, coming up from the armies of the Philistines, and he spoke according to the same words. And David heard them. And all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were dreadfully afraid. So based upon what they're saying, they would come out in battle array. Goliath would come out and go, boo, and they would all run. It says they were fearfully afraid, dreadfully afraid of him. So they would flee from the battlefield. And the men of Israel said to David, "Have you seen this man who's come up? Surely he has come up to defile Israel. And it shall be that the man who kills him, the king will enrich him with great riches, give him his daughter, and give his father's house exemption in Israel." That literally means exemption from paying taxes. So if they weren't motivated by daughter for a wife, maybe they'd be motivated by not having to pay taxes, and somebody would step up and fight this guy. So David goes around and says, "Is this true, what they're saying, that this guy's been doing this for all this time, and this is what you would get if you were to kill him?" And so he's thinking that he should step up here and do something about this. Verse 37, we'll drop down to verse 37. Or let's go to verse 36, where it says, "Your servant has killed both lion and bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, seeing he has defiled the armies of the living God." Moreover, David said, "The Lord, who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine." And Saul said to David, "Go, and the Lord be with you." So David is saying, "Look, God has been with me. He's helped me in these other situations. I've killed a lion, killed a bear." And he's not just saying these things to brag about it. He's just making the point that he did these things and he understood that God was with him. So he wasn't looking on the physical aspects of it. I don't know if any of you have been close to a bear. We have at various times. When we lived in Colorado, we lived at 8,500 feet, and every fall, as it started to get cold, the bears would come down from higher altitudes into the neighborhood, and they would try to forage in any trash cans, and they would suck everything out of every hummingbird feeder they could find, and they were in the neighborhood. And you'd see a bear occasionally sitting in your yard or the neighbor's yard. So one time we chased a bear. It was about 2 a.m. We were coming home. And there's a bear in our neighbor's garage. They left the garage door open. Had already tumped the trash can over and was going through the trash. So I pulled up there and was flashing my lights and stuff to get him out of there. And he walks straight from our neighbor's house to our house. And sits down in our yard. And so I pull up in our driveway, and the bear's on the other side of the car. Or actually, it's on the, I can't remember which side it was. But anyway, we didn't have an automatic garage door opener. And so I told Valerie, I said, if you get out and open the garage door, I'll pull in real quickly and you can shut the door. And she did it. She gave me a hard time about having her go do it, but I had to drive, so somebody had to open the door. But I also slept with a shotgun under our bed because we just had a sliding glass door in our bedroom, and if a bear ever came knocking on the sliding glass door, I was going to try to have the bravery of David. But we also had bears several times at the Teton camps that would come through. It'd be funny when they would come through because you'd see people scattering, jumping in cars and various things to avoid the bears. And on one of our hikes, we saw what we were convinced were grizzly bear paws. So I bring these things up because bears will put fear in most human beings. If you look at a bear and their imposing size and recognize, especially if it is a grizzly, that they can smack your head off fairly easily and quickly. And if you've ever been close to a lion, it's kind of cool, but at the same time, it's a little fearful. It's been about a year or two feasts ago. After the feast in Kenya, we were on a safari, and we followed for a period of time a pack of 27 lions. So there were no large males there. It was lionesses and some younger lions. But the lions would come right up to the vehicle. They didn't come up to ours. I thought it would be fun. And Valerie said, no, we don't want that. But the car next to ours, a lion was sitting, went up on an anthill, sat on the anthill, and was able to be pretty much face-to-face, closer than Julio and I am to the people that were in that vehicle. If you've been on safari or seen them, they're in an open vehicle. So again, if you look at the physical, it's intimidating and frightening, and they have teeth and they have claws and they're fast. And so there's not a whole lot of hope for human beings. But David was able to recognize that God was with them. He gave God the credit. So he's not bragging about what he did with the lion and the bear, and he's not bragging about what he's doing with going to do with Goliath. He's just saying, God is with me, and God will take care of this. So he gave God the credit, and we recognize his confidence was in God. It wasn't in his ability as a fighter. His confidence was in God. Let's drop down to verse 46, where he says, this day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you and take your head from you. And this day I will give the carcass of the camp of the Philistines to the birds of the air and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. So again, he makes it clear his confidence is in God. This day the Lord will deliver you. Then all this assembly, verse 47... Then all this assembly shall know that the Lord does not say with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands. And so we know the rest of this story, where David went out, slung his sling with the rock, and was able to kill this hero of the Philistines, and was able to at that time become more and more prominent. It's obvious that God was working with him and through him, and he was becoming more prominent. But he makes it very clear that his trust was in God. Now let's read a couple of Psalms of David. Psalm 16. Where he makes it very clear that his trust, his confidence, his assurance is in God. Psalm 16. So he was able to see beyond the physical circumstances and recognize God's involvement in the situation with the bear, with the lion, and certainly with Goliath. Now, where everybody else was putting their confidence in their ability to fight Goliath, he put his confidence in God. Psalm 16, verse 1, it says, "Preserve me, O God." Literally meaning just watch over me, care for me. Preserve me, O God, for in you I put my trust. O my soul, you have said to the Lord, you are my Lord. My goodness is nothing apart from you. And so David makes it very clear that he puts his trust in God. The word for trust here could be translated as confidence. But it's literally meaning that he puts his trust for protection, for safety, for refuge in God. That's what he's saying. I recognize that my protection, my safety comes from God. So it's not from a blanket or a stuffed animal or anything of that nature. Sometimes we develop trust in little things, physical things that we like and enjoy. But he's saying his safety, his protection comes from God. All my hope, all my trust, all my faith, all my confidence is in you, is what he's saying here. And then he says that he recognizes, he says, my goodness is nothing apart from you. If you did watch the In Accord with Dr. Levy from last week, not just this most recent one, but the one before, he did emphasize that it is appropriate that every one of us who recognize God's involvement in our lives, that we take the time to thank God for his involvement, and that we make sure that we take the time to thank God for his Spirit and for his goodness in us. And David is doing that. He's recognizing. He says that, you are my Lord, my goodness is nothing apart from you. And that's exactly where we would be without our relationship in God. And no matter our capabilities, no matter our talents, we would be nothing apart from God. And to the saints who are on the earth, they are the excellent ones in whom is all my delight. And so they tie that in with one of the verses in Psalm 119 where David says that those, or the psalmist of 119 says, those who obey God, that's who I want to be with. Verse 4, their sorrows shall be multiplied who hasten after another God. Their drink offerings of blood I will not offer, nor take up their names on my lips. So if we forsake the God we know, if we lose our confidence, our trust in him, it says that we start to chase after idols, whatever it is we put before God. Verse 5, you, O Lord, are the portion of my inheritance and my cup. You maintain my lot. In other words, you uphold me where I am. The lions have fallen to me in pleasant places. Yes, I have a good inheritance. Verse 7, I will bless the Lord who has given me counsel. My heart also instructs me in the night seasons. And so when it's dark, whether in life or at night, he knows as far as his heart. It literally could be translated kidneys. So it's just saying his innards. He knows in his gut who God is and that God protects him and watches over him. So in his heart he has truth. So he meditates, he thinks about that when it's dark. I've set the Lord always before me, because he is at my right hand, I shall not be moved. Therefore my heart is glad, and my glory rejoices. My flesh also will rest in hope. So he's saying my body, my mind, I rest in hope, the hope that God gives. For you will not leave my soul in Sheol or in the grave, nor will you allow your Holy One to see corruption. You will show me the path of life. In your presence is fullness of joy. At your right hand are pleasures forevermore. And so we see David describing the fact that he recognizes his trust is in God. He's saying, I trust you. I put my hope in you. I depend upon you for my protection, for my help, for my safety, for all things. That's what he's explaining here. And he goes through talking about how this affects his life. Because he's able to do this, then he has God's ways in his heart. He's able to meditate on it. He says, I've set the Lord always before me. So his confidence in God is not shaken. He doesn't allow that to become shaken. And he talks about being at God's presence, at your right hand are pleasures forevermore. So we recognize this psalm, we recognize what David is saying here, and we recognize Psalm 23. How many of you know Psalm 23 without having to turn there? I think most of us do, and I know Mr. Jackson covered it in detail not too long ago. But I want to take I'm not going to spend a lot of time there, but I want to look at it because David is emphasizing the same ideas or the same concepts that he just emphasized in Psalm 16. So, just six verses here. The Lord is my shepherd, Psalm 23. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside the still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in the path of righteousness for His name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. For You are with me. Your rod, Your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup runs over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. There's a debate in commentaries and by biblical scholars as far as when David wrote this psalm. But it's interesting reading through this. Of course, we know that he was a shepherd, and he understood the care that a shepherd gives sheep. But when you read the graphic words that he uses to describe how he views his life, we just read that he puts all of his trust in God, and it says, the Lord is my shepherd. And so that means his guide, his someone to care for him, to watch over him, to protect him. And he doesn't have anything that he wants because his life is in the hands of God, and he has perfect confidence in what God is able to do. And so then the pictures that he describes as far as lying down in green pastures, that indicates that there's peace, there's serenity, there's not confusion. If he wants food, he can get food, because if it wasn't green pastures, then they're on the march. There have been times when I've gone through parts of Kenya where it's just very dry. It seems like they're hit or miss, where they will have too much rain or they won't have enough rain. But I've seen them before moving their cattle and their sheep. A lot of times it's 5 and 6 year old boys who are herding these herds of animals looking for pasture land. And there's constant battles still going on over there because the farmers want the land to raise crops. The herders want the land to raise herds, and they need the land for the feeding of the animals. So there's this fighting that goes back and forth. Well, David's picturing this pasture that's green and that he is being fed. And still waters represents that calmness and that peace again, that they're able to drink from those waters and don't have to worry about being fallen in or being swept away. And when it says he restores my soul, meaning that God literally just encourages him in his life, that he is encouraged when he needs encouragement. So if he gets down, if he gets discouraged, he recognizes that God restores him, that God encourages him and leads him in the way that he should go. David says he walks through the valley of the shadow of death, but he doesn't fear any evil because he recognizes that God is watching over him. So he goes through and he paints these pictures. Now, let's put this in context of no matter when David wrote this, what was David's life like? How often did he really dwell in green pastures? Now, we know he lived in the big house when he was king. But leading up to that point, let's go back here for a moment. He just killed Goliath. We read about that in 1 Samuel 17. So all the people like him, and the king is going to give him a daughter in marriage. So he's going to have a wedding, and all these wonderful things are happening to this young man. And the people celebrate this. And what happens then? Well, the king gets jealous. And not only that, the king tries to kill him. So David has to flee. He has to leave his family. And what's he do then? Well, he dwells in rocks and caves and fields and various places. And He's a nomad. He moves from place to place. And even after this, after he's able to survive Saul trying to kill him, what goes on in his life? We know that he develops a reputation as a bloody man. Estimates are that David fought in 66 different battles. Now, there's some debate on that because some terminology, they're not sure if it was a battle or not where it says he took up the sword. But somewhere in that neighborhood, that's a lot of battles and wars that somebody's fighting in. So does that describe green pastures and still water? Now, maybe it describes eating in front of your enemies from time to time, as it says, but David is picturing these things, but he lived his life on the run, often fleeing for his life. He gets to a point in life where we know, it's in the Bible, he commits adultery, he commits murder to try to cover up that adultery. Then a prophet tells him, "You're a sinner," and he recognizes that he was getting to the point where he could possibly lose God's Spirit. We know from Psalm 51, where he asked God not to take his Spirit from him. So David went through a very trying and very difficult time in regards to that. And then, beyond that, he has all these family problems. What do you expect with five wives and concubines and children from different marriages and all these things that are taking place and all these kids who want to be king? And then your kids rebel against you, and I don't mean just a little bit, they stay out past curfew. No, they want to kill you, and they want to take your house, and they want to take your things, and they want to be king. So does this sound like somebody living in green pastures, in peace, in harmony, in prosperity? We know that he's devoted to God. He writes all these beautiful psalms, and we know that he was someone that was musically talented, as Mr. Ortega we recognize as musically talented. But he was someone that was musically talented, and I just want to make the point, he was devoted, other than the time where we know he drifted away from God, but he was devoted to God. He wanted to worship God. He wanted to sing songs of praise to God, and he wanted to build God a temple. And what did God tell him? "You can't build my temple. You're a bloody man. You are not someone that I can use to build my temple." So I wanted to put this Psalm 16 and 23, in context to what was going on in David's life. David could have easily looked at the physical and just said, "God, I just had confidence in you. I just killed that big guy. And what do I get for it? Yeah, I had a party, but now I'm fleeing for my life. The king is trying to kill me." So all this stuff is going on, and throughout his life, David had trials. Even as he got older, he died at 70 years old, and he couldn't even keep his body heat. He had health problems as he got older. So we recognize David went through a lot of trials as a physical human being. Yet he was someone we know that had God's Spirit, someone we know that will be in God's kingdom. But because he could place his faith, his trust, his confidence in God and in the spiritual, what we see described from these psalms that he wrote is stability and poise, a certain balance in life, a certain perspective of keeping the spiritual in focus and not the physical. We see a peace of mind. That's what these psalms describe, is a peace of mind and composure. And most importantly, he had a very strong focus when you read these verses. Verse 6, where it says, "Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Eternal forever." So because he was able to put his trust and his confidence in God and in the spiritual, no matter what was going on in his life, we see that when he was close to God, we know there's exception, but we see that he was able to focus on the future, on dwelling with God. So in Psalm 16 and in Psalm 23, he talks about dwelling with God. By putting his confidence in God, he's recognizing that it does give him stability in life. It does give him poise and balance and peace of mind and composure. And it gives him focus. Focus on dwelling in the house of the Eternal forever. So it's important that we recognize the benefits of putting our trust in God. Those of you who have children or have had children, as you rear them and strive to teach them of God, maybe you do what we did when our kids were young. We would, from time to time, write out scriptures and put it in their bedroom or somewhere where they could look at them and hopefully start to memorize them and be able to apply them in their lives. So if you want to test Brianna and ask her memory scriptures from when she was 5 and 6, go ahead. But one of the ones that we tried to emphasize for our children was Proverbs chapter 3. Let's turn there. Because one of the most important things in teaching our children about God's way of life is cause and effect. So we know the Bible says time and chance happens to everyone, so time and chance can happen to us. But we also know that based upon our choices in life, there are many outcomes, cause and effect. And in Proverbs chapter 3, verses 5 and 6, here's one of the verses that I remember writing and putting on a piece of paper and taping in the girls' room. Verse 5, it says, "Trust in the Lord with all your heart." So it's that same trust and confidence that we recognize that David had in God. That no matter what was going on around him, he was able to recognize that his protection, his deliverance, his sustenance, it all came from God. So trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. Now this leaning, or this lean for lean not, it's a verb that means if you're doing this, then you're putting your trust or your faith in yourself. So it's a verb that describes that you're putting your trust on your own understanding, if you're leaning on your own understanding. So we're told not to do that, because human nature has a way of justifying anything we want it to justify. We can use our means of thinking, whatever it might be, to come to a conclusion that we want it to, that whether it goes with or against God's way of life. If we're leaning on our own understanding, if we're putting our trust in ourselves. So we're told to trust in God with our own heart. And if we do that, it says, if we in all our ways acknowledge Him, He shall direct your path. Literally, it means He shall make your path smooth. Now, when we read Psalm 23, it sounds like a beautiful picture. Green pastures, still water, all these sheep bleeding. And not bleeding, but bleeding, bah, making all those noises, all that stuff that sheep do. And they're just peaceful, and they're happy, and there's no wolves. Nothing's going on that's messing up with their tranquility and their peace. That's the picture that David's painting because of his trust in God. But David had trials, and David had difficulties. But his trust in God allowed him to see through that and recognize what God was doing with him and through him. Now let's look at Acts chapter 4. There's a verse here that describes Peter and John. In Acts chapter 4, verse 13, so the people around, it says, "Now when they saw the boldness of Peter and John and perceived that they were uneducated and untrained men, they marveled and they realized that they had been with Jesus." So here were a couple of men that they did not consider to be the elite or the educated, and yet they were preaching and they were teaching as people who had authority, and they were coming across in a way that was very eloquent and bold, and people were understanding. And the people were impressed, especially in how bold they were. This boldness means courage and confidence. So Peter and John, at this point, they were very confident in the truth. They were very confident in God's way of life. They were very confident in God's plan. And there was no denying or hiding who or how they were. It says they were bold. They were boldly doing this. Boldly going where no man has gone before. So they were doing it in such a way that people were recognizing that it was different. And they said, now wait a minute. Didn't they spend time with Jesus? So with Christ. And what happened just a little bit even before this time? Let's go back just a little bit in Luke chapter 22. You might remember this, because this is where, I'm sure you'll remember it. Peter said, I will never leave you. He's talking to Jesus Christ. He says, I won't leave you. The other ones, they might leave you, but I will never leave you. Luke 22, verse 54. Luke 22, verse 54, where it says, then having arrested him, so this is Jesus Christ, they led him and brought him into the high priest's house, and Peter followed at a distance. Now when they had kindled a fire in the midst of the courtyard and sat down together, Peter sat among them. And a certain servant girl, in verse 56, seeing him as he sat by the fire, looked intently at him and said, this man was also with him. But he denied him, saying, woman, I do not know him. So we see that even though he boldly pronounced he wouldn't deny Christ, even if the other disciples did, he wouldn't. We see very clearly, verse 57, but he denied him, saying, woman, I do not know him. Verse 58, and after a little while, another saw him and said, you are also of them. But Peter said, man, I am not. Then after about an hour had passed, another confidently affirmed, saying, surely this fellow was also with him, for he is the Galilean. But Peter said, man, I do not know what you are saying. And immediately, while he was still speaking, the rooster crowed. And that says, the Lord turned and looked at Peter, and Peter remembered the word of the Lord, how he said to him, before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times. And Peter went out and wept bitterly. Now, I wanted to read that section of Scriptures just to make compare and contrast between that and Acts chapter 4. So in the section of Scriptures in Luke, we see that Peter, based upon confidence in himself, he boldly made that proclamation that he would not forsake Jesus Christ. He was very confident in himself and who he was and that he would never do this. And Christ said, yes, you will. And he says, no, I won't. And so he just recognized, after having that time of being eye to eye, eye contact with Jesus Christ, of recognizing, yes, I did. I did deny him. So I might have said it in confidence. I might have said it boldly, but I couldn't follow through on it. But by the time we get to Acts 4, and after they have received God's Holy Spirit, that verse where we read that Peter and John, it says, when they saw the boldness of Peter and John, now they had confidence in God. So Peter wasn't doing this out of confidence of his own ability. He had been with Christ. He had witnessed the life, the death, the resurrection of the Messiah. And he was boldly confident in the truth, in preaching it, in living it, in being a part of it. So can we have this same boldness? Or is it possible that you and I can have the same confidence as was describing Peter and John, that they were so bold because of the truth, because of what they knew, because they'd been with Christ, that they were going to live God's way of life no matter what? No matter what was going on around them, they were in green pastures next to still water with Christ as their protector. Well, have you been with Christ? So they make that statement. Oh yeah, these people, they were with Christ, so we recognize they're different. So have you been with Christ? That's kind of a funny statement. And I don't know if I've ever asked any of you that before directly. But if we want to have this confidence in God and God's way of life and this boldness that they talk about here describing these people, then we need to ask that question, because they knew that's where it came from, that they'd been with Jesus. So have you or have I been with Christ? Well, does the Spirit of God dwell in you? Because that means that Christ abides in us. I'll just refer to Galatians chapter 2, verse 20, where it says that Christ lives in us. So we've been crucified, and we live, but not us alive, but Christ living in us. Our lives are Jesus Christ. So Christ dwells in us, abides within us. Now, how many of you have partaken of Passover? Or hope to in the future? So what do we do at Passover? We drink the wine, we eat the bread, the blood and the body of Jesus Christ. We partake of that. So yes, even though it might sound kind of Protestantly or differently than we might word things, have you been with Jesus? Yes, we have. And so we should be confident and faithful, full of faith in what God is doing with us and through us. So that no matter what's going on in our life, we can recognize that we can have this peace of God, this stability, this poise, this balance, this composure, and this focus. So whenever I preach or talk about confidence, I like to turn to one of my favorite scriptures, Philippians chapter 1. And this term is a very similar term as far as this confidence in God. The courage, the confidence, the trust. Philippians chapter 1 and verse 6. Where we are told that we, being confident of this very thing, that he who has begun a good work in you will complete it until the day of Jesus Christ. And we recognize that means that we can have confidence if we believe God is working with us, if we believe that through the Spirit, the power of God, that Jesus Christ dwells in us and with us, we can have the same confidence that David did. No matter what battles we go through, no matter what struggles, what trials, what difficulties, no matter what confusion's going on around us, if we have that confidence in God, our Creator, our life giver, then we can have stability, poise, balance, peace, composure, and focus on the fact that we have the opportunity to live with God for eternity.